I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
Clearly, we think the climate crisis is a very big deal. But not everyone does. Political polarization and misinformation have led many people to become confused or completely disengaged from conversations about the climate. Will Hackman is working on a way to address that disengagement.
Will is an environmental policy advocate working in Washington, D.C., who has dubbed himself the Climate Explainer. Through his advocacy and a new book he's writing, Will is connecting people to their personal stake in protecting our planet with the hope that more widespread support will lead to the policy outcomes we need to decarbonize our economy.
Take a listen.
Hi, I'm Will Hackman. I have worked in the nonprofit NGO community for over a decade, doing international ocean conservation around the world and Western public lands conservation across the Western United States and Alaska. Before that, I was a political fundraiser and campaign manager on federal races all over the country for years. And before that, I was an Alaskan Bering Sea crab fisherman and commercial salmon fisherman in Alaska. So I credit the time that I spent in the ocean in Alaska as really, getting that salt water into my veins and really kind of getting me interested in ocean conservation, which then led into climate awareness and climate change advocacy. But so now I consider myself a political issue advocate.
Yeah, you call yourself a climate explainer. And so that's kind of an interesting way of describing yourself. Could you tell us a little bit more what that means for you and why it's important?
Yeah, so I am working on a new book project on climate change that kind of tells my personal story in relation to climate change. So I have a lot of personal stories from Alaska, from, you know, Hurricane Katrina to lots of other personal impacts that climate change has had in my life. And so as I'm exploring this new book project, I'm starting a conversation on climate change and really trying to reframe that conversation to the personal perspective so that people don't consider climate change something that's 20 to 50 years down the line or only happens in Alaska or is something about polar bears or glaciers that are thousands of miles away that they're never going to see. You know, it's something that each of us can tell a personal story about, no matter what part of the country we live in or what socioeconomic status we are, or even what knowledge we have about the science of climate change or exactly what's happening. But we know that things are different. We know that the summers are a little bit different in some way, or the winters are a little bit different, or our utility bills are a little bit more expensive, or, you know, it's harder to get the same food that we got before. But one of the things that I've found over time is that the United States has an interesting relationship with our understanding of climate change. There is a lot of misinformation. There is a lot of disinformation. So, you know, explaining climate, the climate explainer, you know, idea that I've kind of taken on is to try to bring a better understanding of what's happening in environmental news, you know, public policy, which I know a lot about, you know, the business community, really even things that other journalists are writing about climate change that may not fully capture the story. I can't tell you how frustrated I was with the media community about their misunderstanding of whether or not the United States was still in the Paris Agreement. You know, for years they were reporting the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Agreement when we didn't actually pull out until, I think, 2 days after the 2020 presidential election. And so just basic things like that, that people still can't quite get right in the United States. And it's a problem. I mean, those things add up. You know, they add up to a misunderstanding of climate change. And so I'm trying to, you know, I've learned a lot about it from a lot of different perspectives. So I'm just trying to give people an easier blueprint to understanding this complex issue.
You know, I am from Europe, as you maybe know, or not. And it seems to me, like, for example, there was Al Gore. And then after he wasn't elected for president, he brought out that film, The Inconvenient Truth. And it seemed the United States are extremely aware of climate change, and actually really ahead. But now it's kind of flip-sided, and there are these people, some people like extremely ahead, and then the rest kind of not aware. So I'm not sure if there's a collectively lagging behind. I would actually not agree on that at all. But there is sort of this split of yes, we have to push, and then oh no, not at all. You know, this is not even existing.
You know, I think there's always been a ceiling on understanding about climate change in the United States. There's been a core who have always been concerned, and they've gotten it. You know, the true believers who believe that climate change is real and caused by humans. So the Pew Research Center did a recent poll that was great that showed that 63% of American adults say climate change affects their local community. So on the surface, that's majority, right? 63%. You might think, well, we've got a majority. We can make change. Although I think anybody who's been following Congress recently realizes that 63% is not enough in many instances to actually make the change that we need. So if you look at that same poll, if you break it down by party, it's 83% of Democrats believe that climate change affects their local community, and only 37% of Republicans. So that is the challenge that we face in one survey to a pretty clear extent in my mind. And so what we need to do, in my opinion, is to make climate change personal to people. And the reason that we haven't been able to get beyond that ceiling is that people don't feel that climate change is something that personally impacts them and their lives and their families' lives. The one hook that I use that I think is interesting is, so what I say is that Earth doesn't care about you. So there's this idea that I think a lot of climate activists have that they're saving the Earth, you know, and I mean, Google 1 million species in decline at the hands of human destructiveness. That was one of the recent UN biological diversity or biodiversity reports that came out, you know, nature in decline by humans. So it's separating those two things out, right? You have nature on one side and you have humanity on the other side. That is completely the wrong approach, in my opinion. We are part of nature. We are doing this to save ourselves as much as we are trying to save nature. Nature doesn't care if we save it. You know, it's going to be around for a lot longer than we are. You know, this is about us saving our place within nature before it's too late. And so if we reframe it to the personal and we reframe it to the fact that, look, solving climate change isn't about sea turtles and polar bears, which, I mean, I care about those things. I work to protect those things all day, every day. That is what I do for my job professionally. But I also understand that not everybody connects with that nature argument. And, you know, but if you tell them this is about your security in the future, we are trying to ensure human civilization has the stability to exist into the future within the natural world that we rely on, I think people are like, oh, okay, well, that makes more sense.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I really think, conversations around climate change are really about human survivability, not about Earth survivability, because it's Atlas Shrugged, right? Atlas, like, the Earth can just, like, throw us off like a fly if it wants to when the time comes, and it seems to be coming quicker and quicker. But it's interesting to me that you have this perspective that if we shift that, it will change the political dynamic. And in my experience with kind of the dichotomy of American politics, where you have almost two completely different, almost mental models of reality, right? And, you know, some people that I talk to are like, you know, as long as me and my family are fine, all the houses around me can burn down. It's just not going to impact my life, you know. And I am concerned that no matter how you frame this, Let's take guns for an example. Like, no one's taking away anyone's guns at the moment, but if you present any idea about rational gun control or, you know, some kind of gun regulation, suddenly it's like you're stealing guns from people. And I wonder if you have a particular strategy on climate change that would make people more, like, I get the personal side, but you almost have to literally be damaged yourself, somehow harmed, personally harmed, in order to get that as a personal story, if you're in a mindset where, hey, if I'm okay, it's all good.
Well, I agree. And I think that most people, if not all people, have been damaged or harmed by climate change already in some way. That's kind of part of the thought process that I've gone through and been able to see in my own life. You know, we have all witnessed storms at this point. We have all, you know, seen something that has connected us to some part of the country that's experiencing a drought or a weather event, or, you know, I mean, not knowing everybody's stories, you know, I think that there is a personal connection that all of us have already seen. And so I help to people to find those personal connections. But thinking about the gun control argument for a second, you know, and how that relates to climate change, you know, people don't want to be told that they can't do something or that you're going to take something away from someone. And in the context of the climate argument, I think we can see that happening as well, where you have these apocalyptic world is burning narratives, which I also think we have to move beyond, because, you know, apocalyptic visions of the future cause people to emotionally shut down. I mean, we know that from Advocacy 101. We don't motivate people by telling them that everything that they're doing is wrong and they need to change their behavior immediately. You know, I think we need to foster a positive and hopeful conversation about the future. And we do still have the ability to build that hopeful future. I mean, look, we're at 1.1 degrees Celsius increase in global average temperature since the Industrial Revolution. You know, if we get to 2 or beyond, that is really the disaster point. But we're currently not there yet. You know, we're not yet over that disaster threshold. And maybe, you know, I mean, that's the whole debate. When do we go over that disaster threshold? If we can wait until 2100, then theoretically we might be okay. If we go over 2 degrees Celsius in the next 10 years, we've got some serious concerns. But we're still in this window where we can think about the optimistic vision of the future. And I mean, if you really think about decarbonizing the entire world's economy and what that really looks like, that is a vision of utopia, that vision of human sustainability that can exist hundreds of years into the future, thousands of years. I mean, if we live sustainably within the natural world, which is something that human civilization has never done, then we could exist for a long time, kind of in partnership with the world around us, instead of, you know, destroying the world around us. And so that vision of hopeful optimism is juxtaposed against everything that the average person sees about climate change, which is fire and brimstone and world is burning and an apocalypse. I mean, think of all the pop culture movies out there of people walking through deserts and, you know, post-apocalyptic landscapes. It's kind of ridiculous, but I think it's also having a very negative impact on people's psyche when they think about climate change. People are almost resigned to this version of the future and feel like there's not a whole lot they can do to counter that future that they know is coming. But it's not. You know, we are all out there doing everything we can to ensure that that future does not happen.
Well, what you know, supposing you do motivate a lot of people with kind of a combination of personal experience and a more utopian kind of projection, what would be the first thing you would recommend someone who's just becoming aware or accepting the idea of climate change? What would be the first thing you would recommend them to do, like in their behavior or attitude or what?
Yeah, so inevitably this question comes up in every conversation I have on this topic, and it is a really interesting and important question because it's the what can I do personally question versus, you know, what is kind of outside of my control. And look, I segment out, you know, environmental protections and sustainability and, you know, doing your part to turn off the light switch or recycling or becoming vegan to reduce your footprint. You know, all of that is in kind of in one category of sustainability in my mind. And then there's pure greenhouse gas reductions. And if we are to keep global warming under the disaster threshold of 2 degrees Celsius, then it's all about greenhouse gas reductions. It's not about anything else. You know, we have to decarbonize as quickly as we possibly can. And, you know, as far as what I'm not focused on 101 things that you can do to solve climate change, but I think that, I mean, coming from the political perspective, you know, we have to vote for people who believe in science. I mean, I think we've all seen the difference that one administration can make, you know, when you have the current administration that did more on climate change in the first week than the last 4 years, certainly. But even before that, I mean, you know, the Biden administration is going much further than the Obama administration ever did. And so the power, I mean, it sounds kind of simple and redundant, but the power of your vote is so important, and the power of really paying attention to the people that we are electing to public office, because we're in this bad spiral at the moment of apathy and political disgust. And the only thing that can counter that to ensure we have the right people representing us is to stay engaged, you know, to keep paying attention. But I'm not discounting any of the individual work that anyone can do as well, cleaning up a beach. I mean, again, these are all things that I do in my personal life as well. But I think it's just really important to keep the goal in mind of reducing carbon emissions. That's the entire game. You know, we can save all the fresh water that we want in the world, but if we don't reduce carbon emissions, then we're going to go over the 2 degrees Celsius limit. And in order to move quickly for that goal, we have to make large scale institutional changes.
Like what would they be?
Well, so I talk a lot about the importance of public policy as a framework and how the private sector and public policy work together, along with NGOs, along with political issue advocates that help make the space for that policy change. Public policy doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, people come together and they help build the policy window for things to occur. That's what we've seen. That's how we've seen, you know, gay marriage and other major civil rights issues move forward in the past. It's people on the ground doing that work for the elected official. A lot of times our elected officials are looking for that support on the ground, but they don't yet have it. And so we have to do our jobs as on the ground advocates to build that support so that our elected officials can do the right thing. And that's why I think we're in this moment right now. I mean, cutting edge science and research coming from the IPCC and all sorts of scientists all over the world has fueled this knowledge of what's going on and fueled this advocacy that's now taking place all over the world with young people. And that has now made its way into the public policy discourse. So now we're in this window of public policy on climate change. And public policy can only go so far, but it creates that framework. And so if we get one good piece of legislation like the Clean Air Act, you know, there's an argument that you can make that the Clean Air Act is the single most important environmental law ever passed anywhere in the world in all of history at this point. I mean, the Clean Power Plan that was put on hold by the Trump administration was developed under the authority of the Clean Air Act, which was passed decades previous. I mean, we are still doing so much under the Clean Air Act. You know, if we update fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks, that will again be under the legislative authority of the Clean Air Act. So these things are incredibly important. The Paris Agreement was a public policy framework that sent a signal to markets and all over the world that the world was committed to solving climate change.
Well, I would like to give you an example. It was actually really good that we talk about climate change today. As this morning, I had a little chat with my neighbor in Switzerland, right? And it's a young family. They have a child and they want to remodel the house. And so they checked in with me and showed me all the plans and it's all cool. And, you know, I like the project. And I ask, so are you going to substitute your oil heating system to a renewable system, yeah, whether this is geothermal or whatever it is. And then the excitement was like kind of going down. And because, you know, why is because, those things are expensive and they may not have the budget for it as much as they would love to do it. And it's like, this is the kind of situation I kind of seem to bump into all the time, yeah, on different levels where we have the technology, we know it's innovative, we know that our glaciers, in the example of Switzerland, is massively melting. We can see basically on every hike. We have a child, it's growing up, and, you know, we'll basically pay the debt. But in this very moment when it's, you know, impacting my personal budget, I will not take that money and, yes, I'm going to go for renewable energies. I'll make a difference here in this neighborhood. I go for it. You know, I'm not going to blame them. You know, I know this is the general, like, what if the municipality, a local municipality would say, you can grow, like, build bigger. This is what they want. They want to, you know, increase the volume of the house. Not a problem to me. Only if, you know, you also invest in renewable energy. What about that, right? Then, boof, here is your building permission. What's your thoughts on this?
So I have two answers to that. So the first is, I wrote my graduate thesis in grad school on the effect of a 30% tax credit on solar installations in the United States, the business investment tax credit, AKA ITC, to anybody who knows, you know, clean energy public policy in the US. But this 30% tax credit, I analyzed about 10 years before the tax credit went into effect, and then the 10 years after the policy was in effect, and whether or not there was significant contribution that the policy made to in the expansion of solar installations in the United States. And long story short, it had very significant impact, and I was able to show the data for how that was the case. And so that one 30% tax credit that most people don't even know about, that made its way into the tax code at one point through budget negotiations in Congress, that helped lead to the entire solar boom that we are seeing right now in the United States. I mean, dramatically increased the expansion as well as the innovation, and a lot with more demand there's more innovation at the same time. And so those public policy decisions that we make, they can incentivize industries to be cheaper. What that tax credit did is it lowered the barrier to entry for solar against the institutional fossil fuel players, and those types of tax credits can be done at the federal level, the state level, the local level. So if you're in a city that cares about, you know, making your skies cleaner, you can offer tax credits to help people install solar into their onto their roofs. And that's what you've seen in cities like Washington, D.C. and others. Because I think a lot of people want to make that change and they just aren't able because of those financial reasons. And so public policy can help provide the funding for those tax credits and other incentives to help people really make those changes in their lives.
Is there a country on the planet that does a good job of this better than the United States, like really implementing those kinds of policies and having efficient systems to incentivize greener, low carbon emission behaviors?
Certainly. You know, I hate comparing the United States to any other small you know, European country, you know, no offense to any small European countries, but there's just so many challenges that a country of our size and geographic territory and in our diversity of ethnicities and religions and backgrounds. I mean, the United States is unique in many ways, including just its size and geography. And so it's really unfair to compare the United. You can compare the United States to all of Europe, but you cannot compare the United States to Norway or to Iceland or whatever. But that said, I've spent a lot of time in Iceland, and I absolutely love Iceland, as well as many other European countries that do renewable energy really well. And Iceland's a great example of, I mean, they're 100% renewable. As far as, I think they're 100% renewable, if not very, very close to 100. But it's geothermal and hydroelectric power. And so they provide all of their citizens. I mean, it's amazing to see these huge pipes going from the Icelandic countryside into the town of Reykjavik. And those pipes provide the power, the hot water. They flow into people's homes. And so this superheated water is coming through people's radiators in their homes, so that comes out and heats there. So the utility bills are incredibly cheap. And, you know, the power, the water supply, it's all very fresh. It's all Icelandic mineral water from geothermal. I mean, it's amazing. So that's one just great example of a public works effort. Because I think the history, I'm lagging on my Icelandic history here, but I think the history is that they were dependent on importing coal for a long time. Not that they had coal, but they imported it for power up until a certain point, and then they initiated a massive public works program to get to where they are now with 100% renewable. And now that is an amazing benefit that Iceland provides to all of its citizens.
Yeah, I actually would like to add to that example that they also cleaned up their banking system after the financial crisis and voted for a female leadership, which I think brought the country pretty well ahead in the COVID crisis. So well done, Iceland.
The other thing here is that, you know, I think it's a little bit unfair. We're filling the gap right now with these public policy incentives to help people put solar on their homes. But that is where we are right now. And I do hope that we can get to a better point in the future where people don't have to make those decisions necessarily. You should be able to select clean energy from the very start. And again, getting back to if you can ask people to sacrifice certain things in order to ensure that they have a sustainable future, and what are those things that you can ask them to sacrifice? I mean, this gets into behavioral economics, and I'm not an economist, but what I think everyone wants to see is that these large-scale institutional changes occur so that all of the energy that people are receiving are coming from renewable energy sources. So people can jack their, you know, heating up as much as they want in the wintertime. They can drive around as much as they want in their cars. They can fly around the world on airplanes as much as they possibly want. They don't have to sacrifice, you know, going to visit a relative in Europe because they're worried about the carbon emissions that the plane is going to put out there. But everything that they're doing is fueled by clean, renewable energy. And that's how you can continue to live the life that we like to live in the United States, but also be sustainable at the same time. It doesn't pass that responsibility down to the consumer to say, well, we're not making the big changes on the institutional level, so you've got to pay more money if you want to throw some solar panels on your house. You know, we need to say we are going to make those investments. We're going to do those public works projects, ensure that everyone has clean, renewable energy and electric cars and electric planes and electric ships. And we need to get to all of those points, you know, in every sector of transportation. And then, you know, people can continue to live the life that they want and know that they're not harming the planet at the same time.
I 100% agree with you, Will. The only worry I have is I don't think everyone needs to understand you know, because if we now, if everyone needs to understand in order then to make the decision, I think we are just too, it's too slow. For me, the incentives would need to be that it's basically a no-brainer to go, whether you are conscious about climate or not, the incentives are there, so the system is basically there to participate, whether you know it or not, into the right direction, right? And let, I mean, when you say we are getting there, it's fantastic. I hope we will.
Absolutely. And, you know, this gets back into the conversation about the Paris Agreement and what the Paris Agreement is and how that will continue to facilitate these changes over time. So, you know, as we've said, the Paris Agreement tries to limit, I mean, it commits all countries around the world to limiting global average temperature increases to no more than 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. And we're already at 1.1. But the best plans that we have put forward at this point from every country in the world still get us to 3 degrees Celsius, if not higher. You know, that is achieving all of the best plans that we've put forward is 3 degrees Celsius. And there's some data to suggest that we're really on track for 4 degrees or 5 degrees at this point. But every 5 years, the Paris Agreement has this incredibly intuitive mechanism built into it called the ratchet mechanism. So every country will submit updates to their plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions within their borders every 5 years. And so the United States is currently updating our commitment under the Paris Agreement. It's called the Nationally Determined Contribution. We're going to release it on Earth Day, so April 22nd, along with the Global Climate Leaders Summit that the Biden administration is developing. And that will be the plan for how the United States reduces carbon emissions under our commitments under the Paris Agreement for that next 5 year reporting period, which at this point will be 2025 to 2030.
You sound so hopeful, and I love, it makes me feel hopeful. So thank you for that. And we wanted to ask if you have any final, like, is there something we didn't ask you that you think is very important for our listeners to hear, and or a way to empower everyone to feel better about the future of climate change?
Make the right decisions.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. I am hopeful for all of these reasons that we've been discussing, because, and I challenge everyone listening to this to just think about the future that we can build with a sustainable vision of human civilization. You know, again, this is clean technology fueling everything, which will have clean air and clean water impacts. This is sustainable agriculture. It's this high-speed rail, you know, electric cars, you know, really a way of living within the world that will be a better way. I mean, I don't want to go too far down the path of living within nature. It's not like we're all going to live in the forest here. But I do think that many new building designs will actually incorporate more green features. I think we'll see more green roofs. We'll see, you know, maybe plants going up. I mean, I've seen these incredible architectural designs already for skyscrapers that have plants going up the side of the building that create natural shade that help filter the water supply coming into the building itself that then go into people's apartments. I mean, there's so many creative, and these aren't coming from environmentalists, you know, and people who want to build a utopian society. These are coming from civil engineers and architects and, you know, people who just see this as a good way to design cities in the future. And so I think everybody should just keep that vision of the future in mind and keep asking themselves again what climate change personally means to you, because that is the key for everyone to really see what's happening to them already, to understand that story that they can tell in their own personal life, and then to see climate change as it unfolds around us over the next couple decades, because it will, you know, we are going to see many changes, we already have, and to understand your story within the context of those changes. And, you know, stay tuned for my book. Hopefully it will make this a little bit clearer.
So what did you get out of this conversation most? What has resonated most with you?
Well, I actually was struck by a few things. that Will talked about?
One, like reframing the negative kind of apocalyptic vision of climate change into something like, hey, this is about humans and our society, our survivability, and we could create a world where everyone is working in harmony with nature and not against nature. And that's a great vision, and let's all work for that.
Oh, 100% agreed. The one thing I would like to add, however, is, you know, you can change language, and that would be fantastic, so it doesn't become this basically battle against the windmills, which we will never win, basically. For some, as frustrating that they basically don't want to live anymore. So that's clearly not a way to go. To take that language and or to develop a language where we clearly address this is a positive way to a positive future, but we also have to make clear that there is no other way. We cannot just not do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but why do you have to make it clear? I think the fourth point that I was going to bring up was something you brought up, which is you don't have to convince everybody. You just have to create a system where that's the default choice. Like, it's a default choice. Take the solar job instead of the oil job because it's paying you more.
Right.
Take, you know, put solar or geothermal in your house instead of an oil burning heater because it's cheaper. You know, like these choices are
it's
a matter
incentives.
Of policy.
It would be incentives where basically the masses would choose whatever is better for their individualistic life or in their individualistic budget. And hence we would have a mass movements towards maybe green energy or renewable energies. That kind of avoids the discussion of why.
Yeah, why do we, I mean, I think the why, like he said, I think the why part of it is over. Enough people understand why. Enough people. It's a majority of the people. So let's start building the policies and make it just a no-brainer.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.